So how should society deal with people who do bad things? That question has been up for debate ever since an eye for an eye gave way to turn the other cheek. The history of criminal justice in the United States has often been described as a pendulum swinging back and forth between retribution and rehabilitation, propelled in each instance by ever-evolving forces such as politics, demographics, economic trends, social sentiments, and of course, crime rates. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this week's edition of the program, we'll do our best to figure out the direction in which that pendulum is swinging at this moment at the State House. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Foundation's $1 billion Discovery Park District, where the Convergence Center is merging companies, investors, and entrepreneurs with Purdue innovators to address global challenges and advance life-changing technologies. More at discoveryparkdistrict.com.
At the top of our show, I noted that our approach to criminal justice has been likened to a pendulum. At one point, the prevailing public opinion will emphasize rehabilitation and the reintroduction of incarcerated offenders into society through diversion programs, educational offerings, and early release initiatives. Then, over time, attitudes will shift, giving rise to harsher penalties, mandatory minimum sentences, and habitual offender laws. So, where are we now, and where are we headed? Joining me to discuss the issue are Republican Senator Michael Crider of Greenfield, a career law enforcement officer who chairs the Senate's Homeland Security and Transportation Committee and serves on the Midwest Legislative Conference's Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee, Democratic Senator Greg Taylor of Indianapolis, an attorney who serves on the Senate Judiciary and Public Policy Committees, and the Law, Criminal Justice, and Public Safety Committee of the National Conference of State Legislatures, Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears, and Bernice Corley, Executive Director of the Indiana Public Defender Council. I thank those last two for having shorter titles than the first two. Thank you all for being here. Normally, I would not start our discussion with a bill that died this session or was not called up by its author, but I am because it got a lot of attention and is likely to be back next year, if not studied in summer study committee. And that's the bill, Ryan Mears, that I guess you triggered in some way,
right.
And that was the policy that you had announced last fall in terms of marijuana prosecution, small amounts, what, an ounce or so, less than an ounce would not be prosecuted. Mike Young, Senator, had introduced legislation, again, got a lot of attention. He called it targeting, he was going after what he described as a social justice prosecution. He says, you know, if somebody like you announces that you're not going to do this or enforce that, it would be the prerogative of the state's attorney general to have a special prosecutor step in and prosecute the case. How'd you feel about that whole thing, being the eye of the storm, so to speak?
Well, I think it's important to note how we made that decision and reached that conclusion. And it was based after essentially looking at the data. You know, when we made the decision to no longer prosecute marijuana cases, we made that decision based on the fact that, number one, we were dismissing 82% of those cases already. But when we looked at who was ultimately charged with possession of marijuana cases, it disproportionately impacted people of color. And if you look at marijuana usage rates among African Americans and Caucasians, they're relatively the same, but that's not who ended up in our judicial system. And, you know, we certainly took an oath to uphold the law, but the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution is pretty clear. And we have to make sure that we enforce the law and everyone's treated equally under the law. And that's why we were making, that's why we were comfortable making that decision. Prosecutors have incredible discretion, and it's important we use that discretion to help people and serves the interests and needs of our community. When I looked at the possession of marijuana cases, I said to myself, what's the nexus to violence? If there's a nexus to violence, this is a different conversation. But we couldn't find that nexus to violence. And so for me, this was an issue about what are the priorities here in Marion County. And I don't think it's necessarily appropriate for the legislature to come in and say, no, those shouldn't be your priorities. You should spend money on these issues when it doesn't have that nexus to public safety, and it also disproportionately impacts people of color.
Greg Taylor, I'm guessing that you are glad the way things turned out that Mike Young didn't call the bill down for floor for second reading. But I think you would agree it's likely to be back. So what do you make of this whole thing? I know you have some bills actually that would ease up marijuana prosecutions in other contexts that we can maybe talk about at some point here. But also there was a lot of concern about the encroachment on on the discretion of prosecutors. I mean, where are you on that issue?
Well, the author is tenacious. I expect it to be back sometime
soon. I hear he's a friend of yours.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine, but I can tell you he's tenacious when it comes to issues that he supports. But one of the things that I thought was very important about that decision-making process was when you look at the disproportionality when it comes to the enforcement, we don't talk about it in other jurisdictions. We always use, for some reason, Indianapolis as the model. But I'm pretty sure if you go out in rural Indiana, there's some discretion by prosecutors in those jurisdictions as well. Unfortunately for Prosecutor Beers, he was the one that came out and said, I'm not going to do it. But I'm pretty sure if you look at the prosecutors in other jurisdictions, they probably had the same percentage of cases in which they dismissed the case after they found out that was the only charge. So I feel like it was a great statement for public safety. It was something that I believe that we've given to prosecutors across the state, and I'm proud of the fact that my prosecutor in my jurisdiction did that.
Now, Mike Young said, of course, it's not just about Ryan Mears. It could be, say, a prosecutor that doesn't want to enforce hate crimes. Do you buy that? Is that
well, we have
he used that as an example.
Oh, but, well, I didn't know we had hate crimes in Indiana. But anyway, oh, okay. Yeah, but, you know, here's the reality. If we micromanage these local communities and local prosecutors, then let's micromanage everything. Let's just become the big state and we tell the locals what to do. I think that's a very dangerous precedent.
Well, you've been a law, right. Senator Crider, you've been a law enforcement guy for 30-some years.
Right.
You know, you take these things seriously. Where are you on this? Discretion, yes, for prosecutors? Because
sure.
I guess it does cut both ways depending on the issue.
And I would say that from the top to the bottom of the criminal justice system, the folks use discretion. And and certainly even when it gets to sentencing phase, we've got an advisory sentence, but there are mitigators and aggravators that are in that discussion. My experience has been that prosecutors use a great deal of discretion, and they use a tool called diversion programs to allow people that are in fact guilty to essentially pay a fee and have the thing go away if they don't reoffend within a certain period of time. And so I think the question and some of the discussion, at least in our caucus, was if we start to see this become a trend, what role then do lawmakers have in this discussion as to what we consider to be the priorities that we would like to see enforced? And I think there's some discussion that other jurisdictions are going to start following the lead of prosecutor here. And
Lake County,
right,
for
Lake
one,
County,
has already
and,
talked about
and
that.
So I think the question is, if it were something else that we considered a priority, what could we potentially do about that? And it's a discussion I expect to continue. But I think the fact that the bill wasn't called down shows that our caucus wasn't necessarily completely comfortable with the discussion at this point either.
Bernice Gorley, I saw a moment ago out of the corner of my eyes, you had something to say on this issue.
Absolutely.
You had raised. So let's get to it.
If you spend any time in our state house, lawmakers are very proud to say that we're a local control state, that we allow communities to make decisions for themselves. And that's true until the supermajority doesn't like what the local control is being used for. Limiting, stopping the sale of recycled bags, raising minimum wage, and then this topic, for example. So I just think we need to be consistent.
If Airbnb, we're a local, I mean, you can
right,
go on.
We could go on.
The
so if we're
list,
a local control state, then let's have that be the case. And then let's use the example. If a prosecutor is not prosecuting something that a community thinks they should, that community can respond by voting that prosecutor out. The people have the most power with their local government, and that's where this discretion, this type of a situation should stay with the locals.
One more question about that. Why announce the policy? Why not just not prosecute people who fall into that category? And is that not the same result in the end, and then you don't have Mike Young upset that you're not?
I think it's important that we send a message to the community about what our priorities are. We have a violent crime issue here in Marion County. I'm going to devote all my time, energy, and effort to reducing violent crime. And if there's not a nexus to violent crime, We're not going to allocate our resources to those issues. And I think the community needs to hear that, and they need to understand this is where my priorities are going to be. I'm going to do everything I can to try to make you safe, but it's also important that we treat everybody fairly. And the marijuana policy wasn't making anybody safer, and you could also make the very strong argument that it also wasn't treating people fairly.
Well, and I don't want to devote the whole show certainly to marijuana, but there were a couple bills. We can make this simple. No bills that would have eased up the restrictions on current restrictions on marijuana that I'm aware of saw light of day.
Right.
You were the author, I think, of one of them that would have allowed somebody who had a valid card, medical marijuana card from another state, to have up to 2 ounces. Another member of your caucus would have basically turned small amounts of possession into an infraction. We kind of hear this year, the same people introducing the same bills. In 10 years, will there be legalized marijuana in the state?
I don't think it'll take 10 years. You can look at the jurisdictions around us, and we can learn. Indiana, for all the reputation that we have across the country, we're very careful about public policy issues. And we're learning from the communities, over 27 of them, that have legalized some form of medical or recreational marijuana. And I think by the time we look up, it's going to be something where the federal government's going to reclassify marijuana, which is going to open the door for jurisdictions like Indiana to look at the medical use. I think we also take baby steps. And I think that once you find out and once we figure out how to regulate this thing, it's important to understand that, if we're not regulating it, it's out there. It's the free world. Let's be real about it. If we think
in terms
of
contamination,
people,
counterfeit drugs,
absolutely,
et cetera.
We have things that are happening out there right now where we have no control over because we don't know who's making it. And if we did, we could do something about it.
Well, the governor has said that he doesn't even want to really entertain any of these discussions until the federal government says it's no longer a felony. He says I'm not using his words exactly, but he says his hands are tied, sure, more or less. Do you agree with that?
So I guess my perspective is a little bit different than the senators here. I'm really skeptical about this whole discussion, and at least until the federal government makes some move. There's all kinds of complications. The current business in the other states has to be a cash-only business. There's all kinds of things that concern me. I do a lot of work in the field of mental health, and if you talk to the medical professionals, if an individual has any propensity towards psychosis or paranoia, this is a product that makes that really much, much worse when an individual uses that. And so I think I'm going to be one of those guys that's going to be on the sidelines dragging my heels pretty hard in this discussion to make sure that we, in fact, implement policies that don't harm individuals at the same time. And I'm not a fan at all of ingesting a product by smoking. And that's another thing that goes along with this discussion that makes it difficult.
I didn't mention it in the introduction, but aren't you also a ranking member on Veterans?
Yes.
So you have the American Legion now that's come out in favor of, so you may have some.
And I tell those folks that at the point that FDA makes it a product that you can ingest in pill form, then I'm willing to have
a
pretty good
really
discussion.
Bernie Corley, would this solve a lot of problems in terms of mucking up we look at how many, Ryan Mears talked about how many cases were going through the system, and 80% you said were basically getting tossed anyway. Is this, you just want to write this chapter and say move on?
Well, it would certainly be nice. There was another pending bill I want to bring up as well that would have made a lot of common sense, and it was 236, actually authored by Senator Mike Young. Right now, Indiana is a per se state, so if you have someone who has any THC in their system, no matter how long ago they consume marijuana, if they are found operating a vehicle and cause some sort of accident or injury, they could be facing criminal liability, though there's no evidence of impairment. And so he offered a bill this session that I thought for sure would have passed. It simply would have offered that a person could still be prosecuted if they were operating while under the influence, but would have alleviated that per se liability. And when we're surrounded by a state where our citizens can go and legally consume and then come back and operate in the normal life and have criminal consequence when they weren't even under the influence, I think is really problematic.
Let's jump into a few other bills now. We're talking about discretion. Let's use that as our segue. In this case, not prosecutorial discretion, but law enforcement discretion. And we had a bill which seems, in all likelihood, that it may end up on the governor's desk. It seems headed in that direction, has all the right names attached to it as co-authors and co-sponsors. It would give law enforcement officers the ability to issue a summons for a future court appearance to people involved in nonviolent misdemeanors that law enforcement officers witness. I guess the idea here, again, is to ease some of the crowding we're seeing in jails across the county. You're the prosecutor. Are you willing to give that authority or that discretion over to the men and women who are wearing badges?
Absolutely. And I think it's something that we have to do. One of the things that I'm really, I think, is important is to make sure that we are very mindful of the collateral consequences that people suffer when they are arrested. And so I've met too many good people, too many people who didn't commit violent offenses, whose lives have been completely thrown into a tailspin when they were arrested. Maybe they're going to pick up their kids, they're going to work, they get thrown in jail for a couple of days. A lot of those individuals are hourly employees. If you don't call, you don't show, you lose your job on top of the wages that they've lost. Now they've got to come to multiple court appearances. And so giving them that opportunity to plan for these upcoming court dates when they don't pose any threat to public safety, I think is truly important. I think the other part of this, too, is you mentioned Indiana being a deliberate state. We've studied this issue probably too much as it relates to jail overcrowding. There was a report issued this December on the topic of jail overcrowding, and one of the recommendations from that report was we need to have summons procedures in place. So the legislators, the prosecutors, the Sheriff Association, all these different groups got together and said this is a solution to the jail overcrowding problem, and it's very important that we implement the solutions after we've done the background research.
And were you surprised? I mean, it has a Democratic House author, Cherish Pryor from Indianapolis, and yet now everybody, you have Republicans jumping on it it still hasn't come out of the Senate, it's in the committee, but I mean, this seems to have, it's a freight train coming down the tracks. Surprising?
Very surprising. I thought it was a great piece of legislation. I actually wanted to author it, but I thought that the author in the House, Representative Pryor, did an excellent job getting bipartisan support for this legislation. Unfortunately, the way the system works in the Indiana legislature is, going back to my tenacious friend, Senator Mike Young, he doesn't believe the bill has any legs. So unfortunately for the state of Indiana, I think we're at a point where that bill may be
coming off the tracks.
Here's the reality about that. Why shouldn't we have a discussion about it? We should be looking at ways to address the jail overcrowding because it solves a lot of the other issues that we have in our community. And I think for those who don't want to have that discussion, it's going to be a dangerous thing to not vote for.
I think it's called committee chair discretion. Everybody else is getting discretion. You might as well give some committee chairs as well. There's no easy way to move from bill to bill, so we'll just jump right into it.
Sure.
Statute of limitations. Right now, if you were molested as a child, you have till age 31 to deal with it. You wanted to do away with the statute altogether. It's been amended. It's been, some would say, watered down. Basically now, if there's a confession, a tape, DNA evidence, that would start the clock anew, and law enforcement would have a five-year window. Happy with the changes? And is this going to make a significant change for victims in the state?
Yeah, I'm happy in the sense that it gives more victims an opportunity for justice. And so if you work in this area, and I've done this for most of my legislative career, you realize the impact that those crimes have on an individual. And so I've been looking for any opportunity to provide extra opportunity for justice. Now, removing the statute altogether would have been my preferred avenue. But if you just watched recently, there was a great report on Channel 13 about a lady who had a case that she received justice 20 years after the fact under the aspects of a bill I passed called Jenny's Law. And those three triggers do work. I know of multiple cases made around the state which are as old as 30 years old, where a victim has had DNA from their sexual assault kit that's matched to an individual later on. And so I'm hopeful. I think the one thing that this bill does is it gives law enforcement the opportunity to go out and actually even investigate the case, which was barred before after the victim reached age 31. A good detective can go out and perhaps get a confession, which is one of those triggers. They can ask questions of the victim like, did you potentially save a garment of clothing because that was a significant incident in your life, which DNA might potentially be recovered from? And unfortunately, in today's world, and particularly young people, tend to record almost everything on their cell phone.
Ain't that the truth?
And so just that questioning process that can take place might uncover evidence that gives that victim an opportunity. Then if you're a prosecutor, like Prosecutor Mears here, then you've got some tangible piece of evidence. It's not a he said, she said. There's actually evidence to support the fact that the incident took place. And I'm thankful for that.
And I'm guessing, Bernice, you're saying, how do you defend something that's 30-plus years old? My witnesses, my exculpatory witnesses are maybe dead, out of state, can't find them.
That's exactly the point. Right. The older, and we all know this, the older a case is, the tougher it is, obviously, to defend oneself. I mean, I will give credit that the language does mirror other sections of statute, and I do appreciate the concrete evidence that has to be brought, but the defense certainly is crippled by the older it gets, the ability to actually mount a defense. So this is troubling.
I'm guessing you still, problems notwithstanding, this is you'd like to have this arrow in the quiver.
Yeah, and you mentioned a case that our office prosecuted that took place where it was a towel that was left behind from the scene that was able to be preserved that allowed us to move forward with a criminal prosecution literally decades later and bring justice to that victim. You know, and I think the other thing that's important to note, that we don't have statute of limitations on murder cases. And so this is not unheard of to maybe go in this direction. And so I think for those reasons, I think it is important to have that conversation. It's also really tough for law enforcement or a prosecutor's office to say there's nothing we can do because you're 32. And those are difficult conversations.
So that's talking about old cases. Let's talk about young people. How's that for a segue? I'm trying. And we, of course, have legislation that would say 12-year-olds could be prosecuted for attempted murder, maybe even rape, kidnapping, and others. I know it's an abrupt shift here, but that also seems that it's on those same rails. And this one won't get derailed, perhaps, to the governor's office for his signature. Should 12-year-olds, this came from the Noblesville shooting from a couple years ago, where because nobody died, the 13-year-old in that case couldn't be prosecuted in adult court?
No. 12-year-olds should not be under any circumstance.
Even with a murder? Because current law, of course, says that they could be waived to adult court with murder, right? You're saying I don't know that.
I don't know how that makes us safer, which is what I always thought it was about. We've established in Indiana that juvenile justice is about rehabilitation. We've also established that adult justice is about bringing justice to the family or some type of punishment. 12-year-olds don't think like we do. And having access to a firearm, which could be very easily done, we see all these accidental shootings that have been happening. I saw last night 41 in the recent past. Where there's accidental shootings. You're talking about harming somebody in a 12-year-old's mind or a 13-year-old's mind. And here's the other piece. And I challenge us to be realistic about this. I brought up on the floor that it's important to understand that disproportionately, Indiana Criminal Justice Institute, we put in law, had to study this issue. Over the last 3 years, Indiana has seen the waiver of children into adult court disproportionately affect young men of color, represent 78% of those who are prosecuted. How can you continue down that path and then bring up the fact that you want to expand that, knowing that we have that kind of disproportionality?
I know you hate to yield the floor, but I'm going to say something that should be criminal under Indiana statute, and that is we're out of time. I can't believe.
I'm glad you gave me that last statement, though.
Well,
we got to talk about
not by choice, Senator Filibuster. I mean, that's we didn't get a chance to talk about, but certainly issue of importance to our state and to our viewers and listeners, and I thank you all for being here. Again, my guests have been Republican Senator Michael Kreider of Greenfield, Democratic Senator Greg Taylor of Indianapolis, Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears, and Bernice Corley, Executive Director of the Indiana Public Defender Council. Some lawmakers think the only thing you should have in your hand while you drive is the steering wheel. Legislating Common Sense on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hanna News Service, and an attorney, I should point out, today's topic. We ran out of time, obviously. One thing we would have talked about was the House concurrent resolution that's gotten some attention. Tell us, this is a moratorium of sorts. Explain that.
Right. It would place a moratorium on any kind of significant criminal code revisions without those revisions having gone before an interim study committee. So basically taking a year, maybe even 2 years, depending upon when something comes up in the process, before the legislature would pass the particular provision, absent any kind of particularly exigent circumstances. They don't want the legislature to go around itself and just kind of pass things willy-nilly.
And because we had that major criminal code reform a few years ago, back at 2013, 2015.
And then we had the antidote for it.
And then people wanted to undo it almost immediately. So will that see light of day, I mean, when this is all done?
Well, it's passed the House. It's on the Senate calendar this past week, and it looks like it's probably going to go through. And it's a resolution. It's kind of an advisory thing, and they want everybody to abide by it, but there's obviously
it's not
a law.
Well, you mentioned calendars, which makes me think of committee calendars. They're not as populated with bills as I thought. What's going on?
Yeah, and there's not a whole lot on the floor calendars either in this past week and coming up early in this week.
Explain.
There just haven't been a whole lot of bills in this session. We had a lot of activity in the first couple of weeks, and then things really slowed down. And then a lot of the bills that came over from one chamber to the other just aren't going to get hearings in that second chamber. So we're going to have fewer bills that are going to get through, and now we're starting to see some bills being amended with just like a word or two changed just so that they can go into conference committee so there can be a home for some of these bills that didn't make it through that second chamber.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure there will still be the usual flare-up at the end, always is. In the meantime, Ed, we thank you for your insight. Much appreciated. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media and Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House news. Until next week, take care.
Purdue Research Foundation's $1 billion Discovery Park District, where the Convergence Center is merging companies, investors, and entrepreneurs with Purdue innovators to address global challenges and advance life-changing technologies. More at discoverypark district.com.